because
okay.
Just the whole legalities of it.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Tuesday, February 23rd meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And we do have quite a wide range of issues today, so this will be like a real rules committee. And I think we'll just start with the first bill on our list because it does have several people signed up to testify. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1600. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1600 authorizes prosecution of first-degree sex crimes anytime after commission of crime if prosecuting attorney obtains corroborating evidence of crime, requires attorney to present evidence reasonably tending to negate guilt to grand jury. This measure comes to you with no revenue, a minimal fiscal impact. You do have a -1 amendment, Madam Chair. It does remove sex abuse in the first degree from the measure. We do not have the paperwork on the -1 amendment right now, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And we have a few people signed up to testify, so I'll just call them in the order they signed up, starting with Ken Noly, Gail Meyer, and Jeff Howes, if the three of you would like to come forward. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. And whoever wants to go first, just go right ahead.
Should I go first?
Madam Chairman Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my name is Ken Nolly. I work with Oregon Voices, a group of families who have someone on the registry. I am here to oppose the inclusion of Sex Abuse 1 in the bill. And I really want to make that argument based on three things. I have submitted written testimony and also a chart and a list of data from the DOC in support of this argument. First of all, I want to point out that the other three first-degree crimes, sex abuse one, unlawful sexual penetration one, and sodomy one, are all Class A, Category 10 or 9 felonies. But sex abuse one is a Class B, Category 8 felony, along with rape in the second degree, sodomy in the second degree, and unlawful sexual penetration in the second degree. It's grouped that way because our laws and our OARs rank them that way in order of seriousness. And the chart I've submitted, while a little bit complex, makes this particular point. We did not, when we passed the changes last session, we changed the statute of limitations for all of the first-degree crimes from 6 years to 12 years. We did not change the Class B crimes, and that means that a person who has committed rape in the second degree of a 12 to 14-year-old child, after 6 years will no longer be subject to prosecution, but a teenager who is convicted of an inappropriate touch could be vulnerable to prosecution for his entire life. That seems a fundamental disconnect with the seriousness of the crimes. And it's partly the problem of that is associated with a second point I want to make. And that point is that sex abuse one scoops up a huge variety of behaviors. It ranges from something like what an adult does over a long period of time with a child that we all would condemn as horrific, to a casual kind of thing that a thoughtless teenager does. Those things should not be classified all into the same huge category, and we're treating them as if they were all the same thing. In the data that I've given you from the DOC, I've given you information about the people currently in the system for Measure 11 sex crimes. If we're talking about juveniles, let me talk about the collection of the whole collection first. Overall, 38% of people in for Measure 11 sex crimes are in there for sex abuse. It's a big category, but it impacts youth much more. 50% of youth in the system are in there for a sex abuse charge. If we are trying to get the worst of the worst with this bill, we're getting 87% of all juvenile offenders with Measure 11 crimes if we put sex abuse forward in this bill. And so I want to argue that what we should be doing is taking sex abuse one out of this, and we should be convening a group to try to break down sex abuse into other categories so we're not treating regrettable behavior by thoughtless teenagers in the same way that we treat egregious behavior by adults. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do oppose the bill in its entirety, but we also, I'd like to address my comments also towards the Dash 1. With respect to the limitation period, in moving in 2015 from 6 years to 12, Oregon now really did move within the range of norm within the United States for the limitation period for very egregious rape and penetration crimes. We are no longer now at the low end of the national norm. A limitation period has its merits and values, and it's born out of recognition that a court of law has inherent limitations. It has inherent restrictions that doesn't allow it to recreate with exactitude what happened long, long time ago. And the longer you stretch a limitation period, the more and more likely it is that a resolution in a court of law will be fraught with error or mistakes. These cases now, and by these cases I'm referring to these four sex crimes, they do result in dismissals, they do result in acquittals, but they result in those in something other than a verdict of guilt, because the defense is able to go out and tap into tangible objects that are present that the defense can get access to. And I have a list on OLIS on some of the tangible objects that have been retrieved by the defense that have resulted in acquittals and dismissals, but they can be things from, you know, security video cameras to check receipts to text messages. They can all put context to an allegation. And if you stretch something out 20 to 30 years, all of that is gone. And so that's where we feel that extending a limitation period does create, it's fraught with error. It's fraught with danger. And while the bill attempts to have some form of balance to it by definitely requiring at least a minimum amount of corroborative evidence, that's only one side of the equation. When there is a dispute, then there needs to be the other side of the equation, and that person won't have access to their evidence. I do want to point out two things that are relevant to the underlying bill as well as to the Dash 1, and those are the lack of due process guarantees that are present in this state that are present in other states. So I want to remind this committee, Oregon is a 10-2 jury verdict state. 48 states and the federal government requires unanimity. Oregon and Louisiana allow for a 10-2. When you're talking about a verdict on a sex claim, a sex crime, that is no longer insignificant. That is the rule. We don't have data, really, on 10-2 jury verdicts, but anecdotally, I can tell you from my members, they can say that almost all of their cases on sex allegations result in a non-unanimous verdict. And secondly, we just don't have the pretrial discovery rights that's present in so many other states. We still haven't recorded grand juries in Oregon, and I don't know that we will this session. We still don't have depositions in the state, and we don't have preliminary hearings in the state. So there's a lot of pretrial discovery and access to evidence that is not afforded the accused in Oregon, and you couple that with a non-unanimous jury verdict and an allegation that's 30 years old, it is fraught with error. With respect to the Dash 1, again, we oppose the bill, but if the bill were to move forward, we would ask that people give very serious consideration and discussion to the Dash 1 amendment, which would remove the crime of sex abuse in the first degree from the list of crimes that would have the extended limitation period. Sex abuse 1 is a broad continuum of conduct But unlike those other three crimes, it does not require penetration. So rape one, sodomy one, unlawful sexual penetration one, those are all, everyone would agree, the worst of the worst of the worst. Those are those penetration crimes. But sex abuse in the first degree is completed upon a touching. It's contact. And it can be a touching of an intimate body part. Intimate body part can be defined subjectively, and it must be done for the purpose of sexual gratification and arousal. Now, there's a few other elevator and scales there. It's divided into whether or not it would require force or not. If the victim is less than 14 years of age or incapacitated in some way, then that doesn't need to be a forcible touching. But if it's an adult, if it's 14 and older, then it does need to be a forcible contact. But this has resulted in huge, broad spectrum of different kinds of allegations and cases. But what I want to bring to the committee's attention is some of the prosecutions and convictions that have occurred with very... When I say minimal touching, I don't mean to indicate that it should not be criminal. But what I'm saying, it is not consistent with the worst of the worst of the worst. There have been prosecutions and convictions for the nibbling of an ear of someone under 14 and for touching the buttocks over the clothing. And this is a famous case that resulted in an appellate decision. But a man had his arms spread out as he was leaning against the beach. A little child was stretching forward to throw their line for fishing, and as they would rock back, the clothed buttock would roll on top of the hand, and the defendant did not move the hand. And then when the child stood up, he whacked her buttocks off to get the sand off, and that resulted in an allegation of sex abuse one. He was convicted. Forcible contact, you've had forcible kissing on the neck result in an allegation, forcible kissing on the lips. And with someone who is incapacitated, there's been a conviction for stroking the lower back of a woman when she was in a state of slumber. So the point here is not whether or not those should be crimes, they should be, whether or not they should be Measure 11 crimes with mandatory minimum sentences. The point here to the Dash 1 amendment is that the sort of conduct that ought to be allowed to be prosecuted 25, 30, 35, 40, 45 years after its occurrence? We would submit that there's a good policy discussion to be had that those really are different kinds of cases than the other first-degree crimes. Bottom line, we think good public policy is public policy that promotes prompt reporting. Everybody is served well by prompt reporting. And extending the limitation period, we think, does just the opposite. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chairwoman, Vice Chair, my name is Jeff Howes. I'm the first assistant to the district attorney in Multnomah County. I testified in favor of this bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I'm not going to rehash all of my testimony there. But there are some things I want to say. I spent more than half of my career, and I've been with the DA's office in Multnomah County for 21 years, more than half prosecuting sexual assault cases in the domestic violence unit and in the child abuse unit and in the violent crimes unit. I'm very familiar with the issues that come along with an extended statute of limitations. Some of my most difficult cases were cases that were at or just beyond the statute of limitations. I was part of the work group convened by Senator Krasanski and Senator Thatcher that worked to draft this bill, and I thought that work group was very productive, very cordial, and a lot of frank and sometimes difficult discussions occurred. The product that came out of it, I would submit to this committee, was made a lot of people happy and a lot of people unhappy, and I think that's the product of good, frank discussions that occurred. My office and the Oregon District Attorneys Association is in support of this bill as it currently stands. We would oppose the Dash 1 amendment, and I'm going to touch on that just briefly. Before I get to that, though, let me address a couple of things that my friend Ms. Meyer said. One has to do with the 10-2 jury verdict, and I know that this is an issue that Ms. Meyer appropriately brings up in a hearing like this. I would just submit to this committee that It goes both ways. It's 10-2 for guilty, and it's 10-2 for not guilty. It's been vetted all the way up through the Supreme Court, and it's been found to be constitutional. It does not result in any due process violations. What it does, quite frankly, as a practitioner and a trial lawyer, what it does is it eliminates a lot of hung jury verdicts. It's 10-2 for guilty, and it's 10-2 for not guilty. It doesn't marginalize jurors that have an opinion that's different than 10 out of 12. What it does is it actually validates them. It says, okay, thank you. We accept that you didn't find the person guilty or you didn't find the person not guilty, but 10 of your peers did. With regard to sex abuse one, I'd be the first to admit that there are cases that fall at the extreme edge of the law as it currently stands. But to negate or to throw out the ability to charge a case under the extended or eliminated statute of limitations of sex abuse in the first degree sort of throws out the baby with the bathwater. In all of my years of prosecuting, I've prosecuted a lot of sex abuse in the first degree cases. They're not the casual touching. They are the forcible touching. And I say that word with emphasis because when we're talking about forcible compulsion, under the definition, we're talking about using physical force against someone's will to touch them in an intimate part, or using a threat, either expressed or implied, that places that person in fear of physical injury or death in order to accomplish the goal of the touching. Or the person would be incapacitated or unable to consent for some other reason. We're talking about forcible compulsion. There are, and I appreciate Mr. Nolley, who's also a friend of mine, there already is a stratification in the law with regard to touching. It starts with harassment. It goes to harassment for a sexual purpose. It then goes to sex abuse in the third degree, all of which stratify the kind of behavior that both of the people that testified before me are concerned about. Finally, with regard to the numbers of sex abuse cases that are currently convictions in the system, I'll just say this as a practitioner in the biggest and busiest office in the state. Those numbers are the direct result of plea negotiations. Those are cases that were charged as rape one, as sodomy one, as unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, that were then through plea negotiations, oftentimes the middle ground that was settled upon was a conviction for sexual abuse in the first degree. I'll close by saying this. This is a good and appropriate bill. It actually does bring the state of Oregon into the norm with the majority of states that don't have a statute of limitations for these four types of crimes, and I would urge you to support it. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I thank you very much.
Okay, thank you all three for your testimony. Did we have any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Senator Boquist.
I have a question for the DA.
Go ahead.
Where were you on February 22nd, 2004? You get my point. That's 12 years ago.
Of course I do, sir.
Right, so
I do get your point. But I also have an archived calendar, and I could tell you exactly where I was with you know, a couple hours' notice.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Just for the record, on page 3, did you get into the district attorney, because you're the one that gets to read this thing. Page 3 of the bill, it says, including but not limited to. My experience in 10 years of this building, that's just about anything, isn't it? Including but not limited to.
Chair Rosenwald and Senator Boquist, could you point me to the line just so I don't...
Line 24, line 25. Specifically the language, including but not limited to, which generally means these are examples but not limited to those examples. Is that correct?
That is my reading of it, yes, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all three for your testimony. And we have two more people signed up, and I'll call them together, and that's Brenda Tracy and Danielle Tudor, if the two of you would like to come forward. Good Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Tudor, and I am here today to express my support of what is now Senate Bill 1600. It is a piece of legislation that is very near and dear to my heart. And the reason that it is because I was locked out of the justice system as a rape victim because of the statute of limitations. In 1979, as a teenager, an intruder broke into my childhood home, basically hunted me down in my own home, and once he found me, beat me and raped me. I did go to the hospital. I alerted law enforcement. I went to the hospital, had a rape kit done. I was also able to give law enforcement a very key piece of evidence, which was the composite sketch of my attacker. And at that time, I didn't know it, but I was victim number 3 in our neighborhood. And he went on to have at least 8 victims that we know of in my neighborhood. Imagine what it must feel like, you know, to go on for several years then in your life thinking that that person is never going to be brought to justice, only to get a phone call about 7 years later from law enforcement asking you to come down to their office and to look at some pictures. And I didn't hold out any hope that he would be in those pictures, but he was. And as I know the story today, what actually apprehended him was that composite sketch that I gave law enforcement in 79, and here it was 1986. So even though it became key, I was locked out of the system because the statute of limitations at that time was only 3 years. Our statute of limitations did go up last session, and before that went up, our statute of limitations was only 6 years. So we're incrementally going up, but I know as Gil Meyer suggested that we're kind of like middle of the road now. Actually, we're not. We're reaching just about half of the states now have no statute of limitations on rape, with both, I know at least Colorado and California are on our heels to pass legislation to do away with the statute of limitations on rape. So it is something that has definitely reached its time. And I think what makes everyone feel a little bit easier about this bill is there are parameters. And we ran into this last legislative session, and that was what is going to qualify to be able to prosecute someone down the road. And this bill very specifically says there must be corroborating evidence. So it eliminates that, you know, somebody coming in, you know, I have 2 sons. The last thing I would want is for someone to, you know, come in 20 years down the road and say, hey, your son raped me. I have no evidence, but I want to prosecute. We're not asking for that, and we don't want that. We want cases, and as it was said in Senate committee, you know, there aren't going to be a lot of these cases that come through, but they will, and they have, though be it, you know, few and far between. And I'll respond to what Gil Meyer said about the state of Louisiana being the other state that has a 10-2 jury, just like we do here in Oregon. I will tell you they also have no statute of limitations on rape in Louisiana. And last legislative session, I had a conversation with the DA's office there in Louisiana, just talking about, you know, are you seeing more cases come up because you have a 10-2 jury and you have no statute of limitations on rape? Is that creating a problem? Are you seeing, you know, convictions that shouldn't be, that aren't true? And the information that I was given at that time is that they have seen no correlation of having more cases because they have a 10-2 jury. And once again, that is with no statute of limitations on rape. So once again, definitely for this bill, it's time has come. Thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes. Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy, and I am the survivor of rape. In 1998, I was drugged and gang raped by 4 men, 2 of them OSU football players. At the time, I promptly reported to police. I had a rape kit done, and I did everything required of me as the victim of a crime. All 4 men were arrested. Over the next 2 weeks, the backlash started.
friends and family turned on me. The DA told me that I had a difficult case. I would have to go through four separate trials to convict these men. My world was basically falling down on me, and I was not strong enough to pursue the charges. So I dropped them, and I just tried to pretend like nothing ever happened. But that's not the case. When something like this happens, you don't forget. It's been proven that trauma memory is not the same as regular memory. These are not things that we forget. These are things that are with us forever, and they torment you and haunt you and change your life forever. I spent 16 years, suicidal thoughts, PTSD, battling depression, all from stemming from this incident. Just over a year ago, I came forward with my story because I finally felt strong enough to speak about it. And that was 16 years later. Through an investigation by the Oregonian, it was found that all four of the men confessed to what they did to me back in 1998, but I was not made aware of these taped confessions. I was not really informed of anything about my case. I was lied to. So because the statute of limitations was only 6 years, there was nothing I could do. Not only that, but my rape kit was destroyed and all the other evidence, including the taped confessions, 3 years prior to the statute of limitations ending. So last year, when this all came out, what I was told was sorry, which for me is not justice. So I joined forces with Danielle and other advocates to attempt to change the statute of limitations, and we did last year from 6 years to 12 years. But even the 12 years would not have helped me because I didn't find out about my case until 16 years later. This bill, as it is and as it stands now, would be something that would have helped me. I have witnesses and other evidence that maybe a DA would take my case today, and I would pursue that because a grave injustice was done to me, and I'm not the only one. I'm not the exception to the rule. We have many victims in our state that are not being allowed to pursue the justice they deserve, and one reason I know that is because we have over 5,000 untested rape kits sitting around, and who knows what we'll find in those kits when we start testing them. But doing things like passing this bill, passing the rape kit bill that's coming up also this session, sends a message to victims in our state that we care about this issue and that we will be there for them and we will support them and we will catch up with the rest of the country too and also be a leader in Oregon. So I would ask that you pass this bill. It has parameters, like Danielle said. It takes into consideration both victims and defendants. It's a good bill. I was on the work group. I'm proud of it. And I would just ask that you pass through and without the amendment. I don't support the sex abuse amendment. So thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you both for your testimony. Did we have any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you again. And Senator Canope, I think are you here on this bill as well?
I am.
Would you like to come forward?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. I'm Tim Canope, State Senator, District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. Senate Bill 1600 is vitally important. I encourage you to pass this bill. Oregon has lagged behind in its advocacy in the law for victims of sex crimes. And we had obviously high-profile case of a governor who essentially got off because the statute of limitations had run on his crime. And there was plenty of evidence later on that crime had happened. In fact, it ultimately admitted that it did. And so there are many, many victims out there who I think would be well served by this bill. It isn't carte blanche. So you can't just make a claim against somebody from 30 years ago or 20 years ago or 10 years ago. You have to have corroborating evidence, or the DA has to have that, and it's spelled out in the bill. But Oregon needs to be a state that brings justice as it relates to sex crimes and sex abuse. And I don't think we do a good job of that today. And as you may recall, on the Senate floor last session, I was very unhappy with the fact that I believe the legislature didn't do the right thing at that time, because we only moved from 6 years to 12 years, and that still puts us at the back end of states who have had laws like this. And more than half the states have virtually 25 years to unlimited in terms of their dealing with statute of limitations on rape and sex crimes. And I think it's important that Oregon join those states. And I have not seen a big outcry in the states that have laws like this that allow victims to pursue justice when they're either able to do so or when the evidence shows that they can. Because we would have heard multiple cases, high-profile stuff, about how this doesn't work. And we just haven't heard that from the states that already have that. So I would encourage you to pass this bill. I have met with Danielle and Brenda and heard their stories and their cry for justice. And I think it's important that we try to provide that for other women. Obviously, it won't affect their cases, but I think for those in the future, we should. So I would encourage your swift approval of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for a colleague? Okay. Thank you again. And that completes our sign-up list. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1600 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1600. Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ferrioli has moved SB 1600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick. I do have some concerns about this bill because of some of the points that were raised by Ms. Myers, so I will be a vote out of committee today to get it moving along, but I do have some concerns about it, so I'm not making a commitment for the floor.
Okay, thank you for your comment, Senator Burdick. Further discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Okay, Eamon, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Excused.
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And I believe this bill had a carrier out of Judiciary. I can't remember whether it was Senator Thatcher or Senator Brzezinski.
Senator Brzezinski.
Okay, so why don't we leave it with him?
Let's go to this one, Mr. Bout.
Yeah. Okay, so next we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1553. And Erin, would you tell us about this?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1553A is a crime omnibus bill that comes to us from the Senate Judiciary Committee. It comes to us for the purpose of the A13 Amendment, which removes provisions regarding unlimited statute of limitation on first-degree sex crimes when prosecuting attorney receives additional evidence of the crime. This issue is now contained in the measure we just passed to the floor, Madam Chair. This measure has a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact with that on the amendment and the underlying bill.
Okay, thank you, Erin. So I think this came to us because the provision that is amended out by the A13s is now in the bill we just passed to the floor. So, Senator Ferrioli, we're in a work session.
Are we moving the dash A13, Madam Chair?
That would be correct.
So moved.
Okay, Senator Ferrioli has moved the dash A13 amendments to Senate Bill 1553. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Okay, the amendment is adopted. And Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1553A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Bill 1553A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Okay, Eamon, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Excused.
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries. And Przanski will carry this one as well. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1553.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Farioli.
I'd like a 10-minute recess.
Okay. Senator Farioli has requested a 10-minute recess, so we'll be back at
4 o'clock.
4 o'clock, yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, committee will come back to order, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4092 and H.J.R. 203A. And Erin, would you tell us about these two?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Joint Resolution 203A proposes an amendment to Oregon Constitution providing that public universities are not constitutionally prohibited from owning stock in companies, associations, or corporations. It refers the proposed amendment to the people for their approval or rejection at the next regular general election. We do have a minimal revenue impact, no statement issued. We have a fiscal impact statement that speaks to the potential cost of the voter's pamphlet and that it's indeterminate until we know how many ballot measures are going to be in the voter's pamphlet. This measure does come to you with 55 aye votes from the House floor. And then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have House Bill 4092A, and that measure establishes the ballot title and summary for House Joint Resolution 203. There is an emergency clause on that measure. It, too, has a fiscal statement that speaks to the potential cost of the voter's pamphlet, and that is indeterminate as well. And this measure comes to you with 55 aye votes.
Okay, thank you. And it looks like Representative Johnson has joined us in the nick of time to talk about these bills. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Welcome. It's always nice to be anywhere in the nick of time after you've been on the House floor for a while. Greetings, Chair and committee members. Mark Johnson from House District 52. Some of you will recall back not that many years ago, we passed Senate Bill 270. We spent the better part of an entire session working on that, and that was the bill that provided the opportunity for institutional boards for our universities. And one of the driving motivations behind that was to give our institutions the ability to manage their financial resources more effectively to get a better return on investment so that we could have more resources for students, for student aid, and so forth and so on. It's always been the legislative intent that they would have that ability to invest in interest-bearing and return-producing instruments, but there is an issue with the Oregon Constitution, which prevents public entities from investing in equities and so forth. So what you have before you is, and you're going to hear from the actual university folks behind me, but H.J.R. 203, which is actually the ballot initiative that would be to make that correction. House Bill 4092 is the language that would appear in the ballot in the title and so forth. So that's what we have before you. It's a minor fix, basically, but we have to go through a bit of an extensive process to make this adjustment. So that's what it's about. So I'm sure there's people behind me that can explain all of it, cross all the T's and dot all the I's.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Johnson? Okay, thanks again for joining us. And next I'll call Debbie Koreski, Jamie Moffitt, and Ryan Hagerman, if the three of you would like to come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ryan Hageman. I'm the Vice President General Counsel of Western Oregon University. I come before you today on behalf of all seven of Oregon's public universities. I'd like to define a problem universities face and why House Joint Resolution 203 and its companion ballot title bill, House Bill 4092, provide a solution. As universities have begun exercising the duties, privileges, and obligations granted in Senate Bill 270, a legal question arose as to whether the prohibition against the state owning stock in Article 11, Section 6 of the Oregon Constitution applies to the seven public universities. independent legal analysis suggests that the prohibition might apply, despite clear statutory authority and underlying legislative intent in Senate Bill 270. That possibility of the prohibition applying makes it impossible for the universities to invest in equities without taking on unacceptable legal risk. House Joint Resolution 203 and House Bill 4092 will formally create an exception for the universities in Article 11, Section 6 of the Oregon Constitution. All seven public universities support this legislation and ask for you to move it to the Senate floor. The legislation would refer an amendment to the voters for the November 2016 general election to add universities to the list of exceptions to this prohibition. There are already two exceptions to the constitutional prohibition, both of which relate to higher education. One exception allows for technology transfer, and one exception allows for stock or equity holdings that were gifted to the university to continue to be held by the university. Universities need this measure to fully realize the opportunities promised in Senate Bill 270. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thanks. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jamie Moffitt, and I'm the Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Oregon, and I am here today in support of House Joint Resolution 203 and House Bill 4092. As you heard in earlier testimony, the intent of SB 270 was to provide the universities with the ability to invest in a broad range of financial instruments, including equities. And that ability to invest in equities is very important for us because it both enables us to reduce our overall risk profile by having a broader diversification of our assets and also to increase our overall long-term returns. I speak for my campus to give you some examples of things that are going on, but it's representative of the position of all the campuses, as was mentioned earlier. So for our campus, in our initial set of public meetings, our new University of Oregon Board of Trustees reviewed and adopted a treasury management policy and a related set of cash and investment operational procedures. They also discussed and approved our plan to basically leverage the capabilities that we have today with our foundation investment team to manage our long-term investments. Including any investments in equities. So we have been working with our foundation for decades. They've done a really good job at managing our endowments and have an excellent track record. Just to give you some numbers, for examples, over the last 5 years, their average annual return has been 8.6%. And over a 10-year return period, which does include the Great Recession, their average annual return has been 6.8% per year. So over the long term, they've been able to do a very nice job of managing those assets prudently and effectively. And our goal is to be able to leverage their expertise for the benefit of the university. And they would be able to do that most effectively if we could invest in a broad range of diversified instruments, including equities. As I'm sure you're aware, we are facing very difficult budget pressures right now at the university. We have rising costs from labor contracts, health insurance, PERS issues, coupled with necessary investments in IT infrastructure, deferred maintenance, and also staffing necessary for regulatory compliance. That's just putting a ton of pressure on our budget right now. And we are continually faced with very, very difficult choices about raising tuition or cutting costs. And when I say cutting costs, I think it's really important to understand that over 80% of our education and general fund budget is invested in people. That's faculty and staff that run the university. And so cutting costs is generally tied to cutting those positions and cutting jobs, as well as the quality of the education that our students receive. So the opportunity to invest in equities would allow the university over the longer term to generate more revenue that would help with our overall financial position and reduce those pressures. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Debbie Koreski from Portland State University, and I am the closer to sum it up. So three quick brief points. All seven public universities are asking for this amendment. It is a technical fix, and so far no one has testified in opposition to this, so we know of no known opposition. And second, I think, which is even more critical, this is a tool that will allow the universities to generate additional revenue without coming back to this building to ask for additional revenue or not raising that revenue through student tuition. So good bill and overwhelming support in the House. So thank you.
Okay, thank you all for your testimony. Any questions, Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask if you could interpret us a disclaimer that I hear frequently connected to the management of stock portfolios. That statement is, past performance is no indicator of future earnings. Can you address that for me?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I would guess that when people are saying that they want to be careful when they're giving advice to assure people that the future is always the future, I think what's important to think about when we're talking about investing in equities is that we're doing that from a long-term perspective. And so when we look at the assets that we have, we're being very careful about thinking about liquidity, meaning when we need to access those assets. And so as we're moving forward as part of our policy, we would have different tiers of investments, meaning a tier that would be very, very liquid for assets that we need right away, a tier that would be a little bit less liquid, and then finally a longer-term tier. And I think the important thing when thinking about equities to that note is that you wouldn't be doing it if you were thinking that you were accessing that money in the next 6 months or 9 months or 12 months, because, as I said, past performance, you don't always know what's going to happen in the short term. I think what's important to keep in mind is over the long term, historically, equities have outperformed other types of instruments. So,
follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I understand the concept of laddering. Different equities timed for return at different periods. But in a three-week period, the unfunded PERS liability went from 20 to $22 billion over a 20-year period, 19 to 20-year period. We've got pretty good asset managers working very hard to keep the return high, and they manage a lot of assets in a lot of variety of instruments, and they managed to, in effect, create an additional liability of $2 billion. Now, that may be erased, you know, by upticks in the market, or maybe if oil comes back, who knows. But isn't it really you testified that you'd be reducing the risk by further diversifying your portfolio. I'm not exactly sure that you will be reducing your risk. You might be asking to take on risks that were prohibited because they were unconscionable risks to the corpus of trusted assets. So tell me again why, you know, shouldn't you be careful what you ask for?
Yeah, again, so Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, in thinking about that, if you were to simply invest in one asset, in one stock, I would fully agree with you that investing in equities in a particular stock may be more volatile than investing in a fixed income, a debt, for example, instrument. What we're talking about, though, is a portfolio. And typically what we're doing is we're investing in fund managers who then have a diversified portfolio. And so the broader range of assets that we have tends to reduce risk because they don't necessarily move in the same direction when the market moves. So bonds may go down, stocks may go up. By diversifying, we're basically evening that out over time. The other important issue is when you need to access that capital. So you might have the value of that long-term capital fluctuate at times, but if you don't have a need that you have to immediately pull it out, you're not going to recognize that loss. If you're investing for the longer term, then you can hold through those periods when maybe the market does decline in terms of when it comes back. It would be much more riskier if you were looking at a situation where you needed to immediately access that cash, similar to how you think about retirement assets in terms of how people are typically advised of what you should be investing in at different times of your profile to retirement.
Madam Chair, I intend to support the bill, but I just will point out to you that we don't let municipalities invest their own assets. We don't let counties do that. But hereafter, I believe we're going to let universities do it. So I guess we're assuming universities hire better fund managers than other folks that are entrusted with public funds. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other questions?
Oh, I'm perfectly happy to sink or swim by themselves.
Okay, thank you all for your testimony. And we don't have anyone else signed up to testify on these bills. Okay, so I will close the public hearing on HJR 203 and on HB 4092 and open a work session on HJR 203.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
I move HJR 203A to the floor with the be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved HJR 203 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries. And I will ask Senator Hass to carry this on the floor. And next, I'll open a work session on House Bill 4092. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli moves House Bill 4092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion?
Only this, Madam Chair. The testators to this bill in support are young enough to observe whether or not the action was folly or wisdom. And I know they'll be watching. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comments, Senator Farioli. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A decade ago, I used to oppose every one of these bills, but I think I've come to the conclusion, as I said, it's time for the seven universities to sink or swim on their own and compete in the private sector. So therefore, I'm in favor of most bills now that give them their own ability to either succeed or fail.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Any objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries, and we'll ask Senator Hass to carry this one as well, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4092. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1599. And Karen, could you tell us about this one?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1599 establishes July 1, 2015 as date for determination of total number of registered electors in the state for purpose of maintaining status as major political party through the 2020 general election. You do have a dash one amendment, Madam Chair. It establishes July 1, 2015 as date for determination of total number of registered electors in the state for purpose of maintaining status as major political party through 2018 general election. There is a no revenue and no fiscal impact on the underlying measure or the amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Erin. We have several people signed up to testify, and I believe, is Senator Canope still with us? Would you like to come forward?
Sure.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. I am Tim Canope, State Senator, Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Sun River, and Tumalo. And Senate Bill 1599 is a 300-page bill that we hope to read on the floor. No, it's actually only seven lines. So this is a bill that you're going to want to support because it will be easy to read on the Senate floor. The debate will actually take longer than the bill itself in terms of being read. But it's really important because what it does is it preserves the really the ballot access for the independent party, and I think it's really important because it feels like, making no accusations here, but it feels like that the new voter may have been just to the detriment of this party and this party only, and I think Oregon voters have really chosen with their feet, and they are choosing non-affiliated, they're choosing independent party, probably more often as a percentage than they're choosing Republican or independent, so or Republican or Democrat. And so I think it's important for us to preserve that ballot access and that voice, because regardless of where Republicans and Democrats are at, I don't think it would be in the best interest of the state or the voters of the state to essentially eliminate, let's call it by accident, the independent party from being a major party. And so we would like the 2020 general election in this bill. I don't think it needs to be amended because, as I said, it is perfect in the seven lines that it has. So I would encourage your support of the independent party as well as the bill itself, because I think it will essentially create a level playing field for what now are our three major parties, and I think Oregon would be well served if we pass this bill. So I would encourage your support of Senate Bill 1599.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Senator Canope? Okay, thank you again. And next I'll call Sal. Actually, I see that the Secretary of State's office is in the room, and they are welcome to come forward if they want to shed some light on this. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to testify. I'd like to just say a few things about motor voter, this bill, 1599, and then also 1501. The as has been discussed, Oregon motor voter is a new way that we're registering people to vote in Oregon. It started being implemented in January, and we are bringing many new voters onto the rolls. When the legislature passed that bill in 2015, there was a recognition that some parties may have their status affected as early as 2016. And in that bill, the motor voter bill, the 2015 legislature attempted to push the pause button for that first election cycle in 2016. Unfortunately, there was a typo. We came back to try to fix that typo in 1501. In attempting to fix that typo in 1501 to adopt the already established legislative policy, there was some additional discussion about other parties and how they might be affected in the future by Oregon motor voter. And specifically in the 2018 election or in the 2020 election. And the Secretary of State believes very, very strongly that this is the legislature's decision whether to abide by what the legislature tried to do in 2015, which was just pause all parties through 2016. If the legislature wants to do more than that and provide an extension for all parties through 2018, the legislature can do that. Or if the legislature wants to do it for all parties through 2020, the legislature can do that. It's the Secretary of State's strong hope that whatever the legislature does here, that they draw that line, 2016, 2018, or 2020, draw that same line for all parties, minor parties or major parties. So the bill before you right now, 1599, would draw the line for the IPO at 2020. If that's where you want to draw that line for the major parties, draw that same line for the minor parties. If you want to draw that line for the major parties at 2018, that's fine, but please draw that same line for all the minor parties as well. That's the position of the Secretary of State. We've been engaged with members of the legislature in this process in the bipartisan dialogue in the legislature, and then also with parties outside of the legislature. So this really is a multi-party issue, and I think that hopefully we're able to reach a compromise today in front of this committee.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so thank you again. Next I'll call Sal Peralta and Dan Meek, if you'd both like to come forward. And Marvin Sandes. Good afternoon. Thanks for waiting so patiently. We had a lot to get through today. Whoever would like to go first, please go ahead.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, let me go first. I may have to go. Ian may have to go. I'm Marvin Sandes. I'm an independent candidate. I'll be on the primary ballot. And I want to encourage the passage of this bill. The Independent Party encourages and will encourage participation of many young people. And if we get them started, they'll become involved in our process. And as you people know, we need participation. We desperately need participation in our process. So I encourage your vote to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Independent Party in support of SB 1599. I'd like to thank especially Senator Ferrioli and his colleagues for using this using a priority bill to help our party preserve ballot access, and also the chair and others on the committee who helped to draft the Dash 1 amendments. As I've mentioned in previous testimony, our basic position is that no political party in Oregon should be weakened or threatened as a result of the passage of the voter legislation. What really caused us to kind of have a moment of panic at the start of the session was the Secretary of State releasing statistics showing that essentially prior to the adoption of voter, 75% of Oregon registered voters were joining political parties. After the adoption of voter, only 9% of the people who were enrolled through the voter system were joining political parties. And that has an immediate and powerful impact on the ballot access for political parties in Oregon. As it relates to this legislation, the impact is on the Independent Party of Oregon. What we did is asked our members to sign a petition encouraging you, Chair Rosenbaum, and the legislature to just hit the pause button on how ballot party status is calculated in Oregon. And whether that happens through 2018, that would give the legislature one session to work out a correction for how we calculate ballot access, or 2020, which would give the legislature two sessions to work. We tend to encourage two sessions because this is, I think, kind of a longer conversation about how political parties maintain ballot access, what parties should have access to the primary election versus the general election, and I think there are some basic issues of fairness with regard to major versus minor party status, in the sense that minor political parties in Oregon are not entitled to participate in the primary election process, and perhaps they should be. So I think there is a conversation that needs to happen about ballot access among all of the political parties. It is being driven by the voter law. We are impacted immediately by the voter law because in 2016, the denominator, which is used for determining the basis of our party's ballot access as a major party, will be set. So there really is no timeout envisioned in the original legislation, to my thinking. Our denominator gets set, and then in 2018 we would lose ballot access. So this would address that. I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have, but that's the gist of my testimony.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from both of you, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Meek. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Independent Party of Oregon. I just have 3 points. First, the Independent Party has existed for 9 years and currently has 110,000 members. So it's pretty easy to do the math. It, on average, has gained about 12,000 members a year. That will eventually level out and may be leveling out now. The 5% level chosen in Oregon statutes for qualification as a major party was based on the existing system of voter registration, which, as Mr. Peralta indicated, 75% of registrants joined a party. Under voter, many of the folks who would otherwise have been registering at the Department of Motor Vehicles and been directly asked at that time, would you like to join a party, will now instead be automatically registered, will not be asked at that time whether they want to join a party, instead will receive a postcard in the mail some weeks or months later that asks them if they want to join a party or not register at all. So the voter system divorces the selection of a party from the act of registering to vote, and that's why it really changes the entire calculation of how many people are joining a party. It's going to go down. It's going down from 75% joining a party to 9% joining a party. So that makes all of the thresholds for major parties and for minor parties much more difficult to meet, because we're going to end up with a system where the vast majority of voters are NAVs, because you've separated out those two steps. Second, this does place the Independent Party's major status in jeopardy for the 2018 election cycle. According to the fiscal impact statement for HB 2177, the motor voter law last year, the Secretary of State expects that law to add an additional 438,000 registered voters by July 1st, 2017. That's in addition to the what would have been added under the current system. Since a major party requires 5% of all registered voters, that means IPO would have to add 21,900 more registered voters by August 2017, in addition to meeting the regular growth of voter registration. That's about a requirement of a 20% growth in membership in 1.5 years, which is going to be very difficult to meet. I would challenge either of the other major parties to grow by 20% in a year and a half. I don't think you can do that. IPO is also in jeopardy in the, for the 2020 cycle. The measurement for that will be taken in August of 2019. According to the fiscal impact statement for House Bill 2177, the system will continue to add an additional 4,000 registered voters per month in addition to registered the folks who would register under the existing system. That means over the subsequent two-year period, 96,000 additional registrants. We have to have 5% of them, which means that we have to attract 4,800 more members, which means over a four-year period, we would have to have a 26% growth in the size of the party, which also I would say is going to be quite difficult. So I would advocate rejection of the Dash 1 Amendment, which truncates the protection for the independent party folks to only 2018, which is a measurement taken in August of 2017, and instead go with the regular bill because it's going to be a problem in 2018, it's going to be a problem in 2020, it may be a, and it may even be a problem after that because it simply changes the entire basis for calculating the 5%. Under the existing system, 5% versus 75% joining a party. Okay. Under motor voter, 9% joining a party, and we have to have get 5% of all registered voters, that means we have to, a majority of those people who are registered through motor voter would have to join the independent party. About 55% would have to join the independent party. That basically increases the requirement on us by a factor of 10 from what it is under existing law. So I would urge you to enact Senate Bill 1599 without the amendment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so thanks again. And that completes our sign-up list, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1599. And I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1501. And Erin, could you refresh our memory on this bill?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1501 was originally heard on February 4th. It corrects statutory reference to insurability of minor political parties to maintain status for 2016 general election based on number of registered electors as of July 1, 2015. You have a Dash 1 amendment, Madam Chair. It would move status determination until November 3rd of 2020. You have a Dash 2 amendment as well, Madam Chair. It permits minor political parties who calculate minor party status based on having voter registration equal to at least 0.1% of total votes cast in each state or electoral district for all candidates for governor at most recent election at which candidate for governor was elected to full term and in receipt of 1% of the vote for statewide office, to utilize number of total votes cast in state of electoral district for governor on November 4th, 2014 general election to determine status for their November 6th, 2018 general election. You have a no revenue, no fiscal impact on the underlying bill, Madam Chair, and on the Dash 2 amendment.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And I am looking for a motion on the Dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would move the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay, thank you. Senator Burdick has moved the Dash 2 amendment to
Madam Chair,
Bill 1501.
Yes, I would like to move the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay, we will vote on your motion first. Senator Farioli, did you want to speak to it?
Yes, Madam Chair. The question, I think, is one of inclusion and fundamental fairness. We know we're going to have a huge sea change with the total voter registration with motor voter. And I think perhaps beyond the wildest imaginings of the folks who were strong proponents of motor voter, but the unintended perhaps outcome, or maybe it was intended, is that folks are not connected to that question of do you want to vote as a member of a party, do you want to join a party? Do you want to remain unaffiliated? Do you not want to vote at all or not run a register at all? So I just am suggesting, as a matter of fairness, if we were serious about pressing the pause button, we should allow the parties to be treated equally through 2020, so we don't have to keep revisiting this question. It is a matter of fundamental fairness. I think the intent was clear that we leave all of the parties on the same playing field for a reasonable period, and I would suggest that 2020 is certainly not an unreasonable period, given the unknowables about how we watch the rapid growth in the motor voter and the fall off of the selections of party or non-affiliations. So I think that's a strong argument in favor of the Dash One, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferriello, for those comments. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would fully agree with the Deputy Secretary of State that, you know, we need to do something all or nothing in 18 or all or nothing in 20. The Secretary of State, in our previous hearing on this particular issue, I asked the question because my concern was, when will you see stabilization from motor voter? And the answer to that is when we go through two election cycles after the implementation. What that really means, and what was said in that public hearing, is that after the November 18 election, after that election, at that point, if individuals are no longer, have not participated and voted, they will be going into the inactive rolls. And we will then see a stabilization of who the active voters are, which then allows the Secretary of State to come back and determine whether this is working, not working, so on and so forth. So if we go to 18, we're going to come back and revisit this thing. By going to 2020, it at least puts us in a position we can go through the cycle, find out how many people are left, what worked, what didn't work, who's active, who's inactive, and then we don't have to revisit it, and it puts everybody. So I think I'm not going to be unsurprised here, but I would think everybody here wants to put everybody on the same sheet of music. The question is whether it's 18 or 20, and I'm saying if we do it at 20, then we'll know for sure when we get to that point exactly what we've got.
Okay, further discussion?
Senator Burdick. Madam Chair, and I understand that argument. I do think it's better to take a cautious approach as we move forward on this. We're really not sure what the implications are going to be. I am not at all worried about potentially revisiting it, and we'll have a better idea by extending it these 2 years. So I would oppose this amendment and intend to support the amendment for 2018.
Okay, thank you, Senator Burdick. And I think we need to call the roll on this one. Amen, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Boquist?
Yes, we're voting for 20, right?
Right.
We're voting for 20.
We're voting for you.
Right, the 20 year, right? Correct.
Yeah.
Then we're going to vote for your 18.
Yes, sir.
Right. We're going to get confused.
Senator Boquist?
Yes,
Senator.
Yeah.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Vice Chair Farrell?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
No. Motion fails. And that puts us back on Senator Burdick's original motion, which was the Dash 2 amendment. Did you want to speak to your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just think that 2018 is a good sweet spot for putting all of the parties on an even keel. I think it'll help all concerned, and I think it's a good step forward.
Okay, thank you, Senator Burdick. Further discussion? Is there objection to the motion?
Sure, just for raspberry purposes.
Okay.
Just to give you a pat time.
Eben, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Yes.
I like my raspberry sour.
Vice Chair Farrell?
I'm going to support the amendment.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Ferrioli, do you want to make a motion to the
Madam
floor?
Chair, I will. Madam Chair, I move the Senate Bill 1501 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Bill 1501 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay. Is there objection to the motion?
Oh, I'm not going to do any raspberries now.
Okay. Then the motion carries. And do we have a volunteer? Senator Burdick, would you
like
to carry
volunteer Senator Farioli to carry
Okay.
Senator Farioli's in a mood to be cooperative with the chair today.
Okay, Senator Farioli will be our carrier on the floor, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1501 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1595. Oh, I'm sorry, 1599. And we just heard this bill, but Erin, do you want to refresh our memory?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1599 establishes July 1, 2015 as date for determination of total number of registered electors in the state for purpose of maintaining status as major political party through the 2020 general election. You have the dash one amendment, which changes it through the 2018 general election.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And I think by the same argument that we just were having, it does make sense to have a pause button that is the same for major and minor parties. We just passed a bill that would do that as of the 2018 for the minor parties, so the dash one amendment would enable us to do the same for major parties. So is there a motion on the dash one amendment?
Madam Chair, I would move the dash one amendment.
Senator Burdick has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1599. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Amen. Would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Boquist?
Raspberry, no.
Senator Burdick?
You didn't have a sweet spot this time, Madam Majority Leader.
It's the same sweet spot.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Burdick, do you have a motion?
did you wish to volunteer a carrier, Senator Burdick?
Chair, I move Senate Bill 1599 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 1599 as amended by the dash one to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the work of all the members. We don't like unintended consequences, and we don't like surprises. And we do wish to have some choice available for voters, but also some consistency. So I'll be supporting the motion, supporting the final bill.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Farioli. Further discussion? Is there objection to the motion?
Not according to the majority leader, so I'm fine.
Okay. Motion carries. And Senator Farioli, would you like to carry this one as well?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Great. Senator Farioli will carry this bill as well.
And, Madam Chair, are you in a mood to accept a motion on after the work session closes?
Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1599. We do have one more bill that we haven't done. Let's move back to Senate Bill 1553, and the chair moves that the rules be suspended for allowing Senator Beyer to vote on Senate Bill 1553. And
votes aye.
Without objection, rules are suspended. Senator Beyer votes aye. And Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I would like the unanimous consent to change my vote on Senate Bill 1553. It will not change the outcome.
Thank you. Senator Farioli asks for unanimous consent to be allowed to change his vote on Senate Bill 1553. It won't change the outcome. And without objection, Senator Farioli, how do you vote?
No.
He votes no.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam.
And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1553. And that just leaves us with our final bill. So maybe if we talk slowly, Dexter is listening to us and will join us.
I read the law dictionary.
This is the bicycle bill.
No.
Okay. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1595. Erin, do you want to tell us about this?
Madam Chair of the Committee, Senate Bill 1595 permits administration of affirmation to witnesses in legislative proceedings. There is an emergency clause on the measure. It comes to you with no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay, so members, this is a straightforward bill. It simply allows witnesses to choose. Oh, and I see we've been joined by our legislative counsel. So we just opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 1595. And do you want to just explain to us why we have this bill in front of us?
Versus a firm, religion versus
non-religion. And Chair Rosenbaum, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, legislative counsel. And this is a very straightforward bill. The purpose is to allow when legislative committees put witnesses under penalty of perjury.
I did not set a trap for you.
Allow them to administer either oaths or affirmations, which means you can avoid saying, swearing an oath saying, so help you God, which some individuals object to on religious grounds. This would line up with the choice faced in court when a witness is put under oath or affirmation. They can choose either one. And this statute did not have the word affirmation, and this bill now would put that in there.
Okay, that's pretty clear. Any questions?
So restated in English, since the lawyer did it, is that it will add the word affirm. So you can either take an oath under God or you can affirm, which doesn't state God. Both of them, you create perjury if you lie. Correct?
That is correct, Senator Boquist.
I read my Black's Law Dictionary. I was trying to figure out what in the world are you doing down here. So, got to figure it out.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1595, open a work session on Senate Bill 1595. Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1595 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
And Senator Ferrioli moves Senate Bill 1595 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion?
I'm affirmed.
Okay, the motion carries. Senator Gelser has volunteered to carry this, so we'll ask
Madam Chair, may I inquire?
Yes.
Has any member of the Senate put a witness under oath so far this session?
I believe it has been done in some committees, yes.
Okay. I'm the first one.
So, Madam Chair, I was about to point out that Senator Boquist is an ideal carrier, since he is the only one of us, I believe, that has put a witness under oath in this process.
I was the first one in 35 years, and boy, did I catch a lot of crap from the president.
Well, Senator Boquist, would you like to?
I'd be happy to carry this bill.
Okay. Senator Byer has a question.
Okay. Comment.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll ask Senator Boquist to be our carrier, and I'll close the work session
different
on Senate Bill 1590. Okay. I'm sorry.
No. After you drop the hammer.
Yeah, close the work session on Senate Bill 1595. Senator Byer, did you have a comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm embarrassed to say that I think I voted wrong on Senate Bill 1553, but I don't think I can change it because it would change the vote of the committee. But I
move
note
to
that I may
rules.
Not be voting for it. I thought it was 1600.
I can't do it. I can't do it.
So I think that would be that you cast a courtesy vote.
Take it as a courtesy vote.
Thank you, Senator Byer.
Majority, you better start looking because you're going
to
need a lot
of courtesy
votes.
Nothing further to come before us.
I'll accept my appreciation for your courtesy, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. And we are adjourned.
Yes.
Adjourned. Yes.
Adjourned.
And we are adjourned.